Welcome to this sacred time, made so by your setting this hour aside each week to come here to be in community, to share in love, and to feel the spirit that moves among us, to hear the messages of this faith, and to be challenged by them. Someone said at the last sermon, you said last service, they said that you'd said before there are two kinds of sermons, those that comfort the afflicted and those that afflict the comfortable. Today is definitely an afflict the comfortable day, so be prepared. At this time of year, a time of increasing darkness, we light candles and fires to guide our way, to warm our homes, to mark our holidays and lift our spirits, to look to stars that beacon to us to follow. Each week, we begin our service by lighting the flame of this community. And Mike, would you light it for us? As Mike lights the chalice, I invite you to join in the unison words of chalice lighting that are printed in your order of service. Candles, fire, and stars. These are the symbols of this most blessed of seasons. Candles for the banishing of darkness, fires to warm hearth and home, and stars to beckon us, guiding our footsteps to the holiest. In ancient times, candles were mounted on wagon wheels that were decorated with evergreens, and they were lit during the dark weeks leading up to the winter solstice, when the return of the light was celebrated. Christians adopted a similar tradition of lighting candles during the 4 weeks leading up to Christmas, celebrating the light that Jesus brought to the world. Each candle stands for one of the messages of this Advent season. The first, for peace in our hearts and in our homes, for peace in our country and in our land, for peace of which the angels sang. The second, for hope. Hope that uplifts our spirits. Hope that gives courage to those experiencing difficult times. The hope that we claim for ourselves and the hope that we bring to others in this season especially. And finally, love. Love for those we know well and those we've never met. The love that Jesus taught. Love for the stranger, for the poor, the downtrodden. The love that heals all wounds and puts to flight all fears. Let us pray we may be guided by the light of Advent. May we live our lives mindful of the values we celebrate in this season. May we share in the peace, the hope, the love, and the joy of this sacred time. And may we bring it to others. Amen. Each week we include a message for all ages in our service, sometimes done by me or by other members of the staff or volunteers. And today, it's great to have one of our key members of our staff, our youth coordinator, Paul Spanigel, do that message. And I know lots of you don't get to see Paul because he's usually with our youth and not so much focused on our time of worship. So, Paul, we welcome you to the pulpit.
As winter closes in, we are reminded of the importance of community, togetherness, and belonging. Deep within each of us lies an echoed memory of a time when we would all huddle about our fires, telling stories of sorrow and suffering, but ultimately of hope and renewal as we hoped for the sun's return. This is one of those stories. It was so beautiful out in the country. It was summer, and between the high walls and deep moat of an ancient castle, a duck had built her nest. While she waited for her eggs to hatch, she began to feel sorry for herself because it was taking so long. She waited and waited and waited. Finally, the eggs began to crack. One by one, each of them released a lovely little duckling until only the biggest egg remained. An old duck saw the egg and said, "That's a turkey egg. They aren't worth the trouble. Turkeys can't even swim. Just let it lie there. Go teach your young ones how to swim. That's my advice. I have sat on it so long, replied the mother duck. I can sit a little longer. At last, the big egg cracked too. The young one that rolled out was big and very ugly. The mother duck worried that perhaps he was a turkey, but when she saw him swimming so naturally with the others, she knew he couldn't be. She brought her brood to the henyard to introduce them to everyone. The other ducks gathered about them and said loudly, "What do we want that gang here for? Aren't there enough of us already? Look at how ugly one of them is. He's the last straw." And one of the ducks flew over and bit the ugly duckling on the neck. The poor little duckling did not know where to turn. The poor creature was mocked and laughed at by the whole henyard. That was the first day. And each day that followed was worse than the one before. The poor duckling was chased and mistreated by everyone, even his own sisters and brothers. At last the duckling ran away. He ran until he found a lake where he could float in the water and dive to the bottom. There were other ducks, but they ignored him because he was so ugly. Autumn came, and the leaves turned yellow and brown. Then they fell from the trees. One evening, just as the sun was setting, a flock of beautiful birds came out from among the rushes. Their feathers were so white that they glistened, and they had long, graceful necks. They were swans. They were flying south to a warmer climate where the lakes were not frozen in the winter. Higher and higher they circled. The ugly duckling turned round and round in the water like a wheel and stretched his neck up towards the sky. He felt a strange longing. He screeched so piercingly that he frightened himself. The weather grew colder and colder. The duckling had to swim round and round in the water just to keep a little space for himself that wasn't frozen. Each night his hole became smaller and smaller. At last, he was too tired to swim any more. He sat still. The ice closed in around him, and he was frozen fast. Early the next morning, a farmer saw him, and with his boots broke the ice to free the duckling. The man put the bird under his arm and took it home to his wife, who brought the duckling back to life. The children wanted to play with him, but the duckling was afraid they were going to hurt him. He flapped his wings and flew right into a milk pail, making a terrible mess. The farmer's wife chased him with a poker as the children tried to catch him. Luckily, the door was open. He got out of the house and found a hiding place where he lay so still you could hardly believe any life was left in him. And so the duckling went from lake to house to lake to house all through that long winter. When at last spring came, the duckling was lying among the reeds in a swamp. Out of a forest of rushes came three swans. The ugly duckling recognized the birds and felt again that strange sadness come over him. "I shall fly over to them, those royal birds, and they can hack me to death because I, who am so ugly, dare to approach them. But still, it is better than being bitten by other ducks or suffering through the winter." And he lighted on the water and swam toward the magnificent swans. When they saw him, they ruffled their feathers and started to swim in his direction. The duckling bent his head humbly, preparing for the end. But what was that he saw in the water? It was his own reflection. He was a swan. Some children came out and saw the swans. The youngest child shouted, "Look, there's a new one!" All the children joyfully clapped their hands and ran to tell their parents. The sun shone so warm and brightly. He ruffled his feathers and raised his slender neck, while out of the joy in his heart he thought, "Such happiness I did not dream of when I was the ugly duckling."
Thank you, Paul. And it's our custom here for those going to religious education. You are led by a lantern, carried by one of you. Do we have someone this morning? Jack Sullivan is going to carry the lantern. It's an honor to carry the lantern. Remember, everyone follows Jack around the church and out that's going to religious education. like us to go into a time of silent prayer and meditation with this prayer from Maureen Killoran. It's called a Christmas prayer. Not gold, nor mirth, nor even frankincense, what I have for you this season, but simple gifts, the ones that are hardest to find, the ones that are perfect, even for those who have everything, if such there be. I would, if I could, have for you the gift of courage, the strength to face the gauntlets only you can name, and the firmness in your heart to know that you, yes, you, can be a bearer of the quiet dignity that is the human glorified. I would, if by my intention I could make it happen, have for you the gift of connection, the sense of standing on the hinge of time, touching past and future, standing with certainty that you, yes, you, are the point where it all comes together. I would, if wishing could make it so, have for you the gift of community, a nucleus of love and challenge to convince you in your soul that you, yes, you, are a source of light in a world too long believing in dark. Not gold, nor myrrh, nor even frankincense, what I have for you this season, but simple gifts, the ones that are hardest to find, the ones that are perfect, even for those who have everything, if such there be. Each week in our service, we provide you with an opportunity for generosity, not just to this church, but to a nonprofit organization that's been selected for this month to receive one half of the non-pledge offering that's collected in our plate on each Sunday of that month. And this Sunday, it is the Nature Connection based in Concord, a nonprofit organization that brings the healing power of the natural world to people who, for physical reasons, mental reasons, are in facilities and institutions where they lack access to the outside world. Their work is important and it's transformational. There's more about them in your order of service. I invite you now to be generous to both the church and to the Nature Connection. The morning offering will now be gratefully accepted. This morning's reading is from the Reverend Roger Cowan. Why is so much of love life like Bethlehem's Inn? Why does so much of love and goodness in our world, of hope and possibility, get shut out? The most obvious reason is that the inn was already full. Those who arrived first were served. The innkeeper probably wasn't mean-spirited. Others got there first. The place was full, and that was that. But just by such plausible, defensible circumstances, personal enlightenment and spiritual growth get shut out from our lives. Our mind space is given to other guests, and what gets our attention gets us. Another reason there was no room was that nobody recognized the importance of the moment. If the innkeeper had known that the child born in his stable would split history into B.C. and A.D., he would have found a room. So we rarely know when it is that something very important knocks on our door. Thank you. Feed the world. Open the door. Share with the world. Let it know it is Christmas time. And indeed it is. And Christmas Eve is only a couple of weeks away. And it is always, I'm looking forward to those Christmas Eve services that I love. The beautiful 9 p.m. service of Lessons and Carols, but also our 4 p.m. family service, where we incorporate all our kids into a great production of the Nativity in a Trunk. That fills my heart with the message of Christmas. And if you've gone to that service, you'll remember that each year, as we're singing A Little Town of Bethlehem, and our Mary and Joseph for that year are arriving, having gone around the church, up here in the front in our recreation of Bethlehem. And right over here, as they arrive, out comes the innkeeper and holds up that sign. You remember it? Recognize it? Well, that scene is a dramatization of Luke chapter 2, verse 7, which reads, "She brought forth her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling cloth, and laid him in a manger, for there was no room for them in the inn." In our very affluent and busy holiday culture, I think we often read over that no room at the inn part of the story. We don't think much about the difficult journey through hostile land that Mary and Joseph had to travel. We don't think of them really as the stranger trying to find a safe place for their child to be born. We don't think a lot about them as the poor, the have-not. We don't think about them as being part of an oppressed people. It's all there in the story, but we pass by it quickly. It's just sort of the prelude, and we arrive at the idealized stable, a sort of charming, quaint place where animals are peaceful and quiet and loving, where visitors arrive and all are received, and even some bringing rather exotic and expensive gifts. For most of us, Christmas time is a time of plenty, a time, in the words of that pop song, where we let in the light and we banish the shade and we have fun. But there's more to that, as there was more to the song. For many, it's not that. The cold, the hungry, the oppressed, the stranger among us don't know this Christmas. Those who find no room or no food or no protection don't know this charming, sweet, comfortable part of the Christmas story. We forget that their stories of exclusion and oppression, of not having a part in the bounty of the world, are part, a big part, of the real Christmas story, a part that amidst the fun of the holidays, we need to take time to remember. You know, in other cultures, there is more time spent on this no room part of the story. In Mexico, there's the custom of the posada, which involves people dressed as Mary and Joseph, going from door to door in their community, knocking and asking to be let in, but being refused at house after house until finally they arrive at the one house that will let them in. In this reenactment, the folks at each of those houses are the innkeepers. And I think to one degree or another, all of us are innkeepers. And we all at times hold up that sign saying, no room. No room in our lives. No room in our hearts. And I think we as a society, as a nation, far too often hold up that no room for you sign. As Reverend Roger Cowan asked in that reading I shared, why is so much of life like Bethlehem's Inn? Why does so much of love and goodness in our world, of hope and possibility, get shut out, denied? Perhaps it is just because someone else got there first, but if that's the case, I think we have to ask what advantages the person who arrived first had. And isn't there more to go around? More likely, I think we don't make room because we really don't fully perceive or want to fully perceive the problem. We have our own concerns and self-interest. We also have our own fears and anxiety. Some of those fears are caught up in this idea that making room for someone else means there's less for us. We are unwilling to move aside to make space. Too often we as a society and as individuals are the innkeepers that are holding up that sign that reads, "No room," to those who knock at our door again and again. Sometimes, as that reading says, we don't see the significance of those who knock. And as I reflect on our unwillingness to make room for others, I'm reminded of one of the greatest sermons of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. It's titled "The Knock at Midnight." That sermon is based on chapter 11 of the very same Gospel of Luke, in which we read earlier about there being no room at the inn for Mary and Joseph. And in that story, a man knocks on his neighbor's door at midnight, asking for loaves of bread, because he has had guests arrive and he has nothing to feed them. The neighbor does not answer the door, but shouts out, "Don't bother me, the door is now shut. My children are in bed. I cannot get up and give you anything. Go away." You see, it's midnight, not a convenient time to open the door, to make room. Eventually, the neighbor says to the man who knocks, "I really don't want to know your situation, particularly not at this time of night." But as King reminds us again and again in that wonderful sermon, it is midnight, a dark time literally, but also figuratively for many people. And today, right now, many are knocking at doors simply because it is midnight for them. And yes, they knock when we are resting or busy or not interested in knowing their troubles. It's midnight, or it was midnight, or thereabouts, when those two young travelers, ready to have a child, knocked at the door of inns and were told there was no room. It wasn't a convenient time. But that posada continues, not just in a reenactment of the ancient Christmas story, but it continues today in real time, a real posada. People are knocking on doors, asking us to make room. People are going from door to door, be it the doors of our churches or of our government or of your heart. And they're asking us to make room for them. They're saying in many different ways that it's midnight for them, a dark time for them and for those like them. And right now, I do think it's midnight for many. I think it's midnight for those immigrants who are among us without the right papers, for whom we as a nation are willing to take their labor, but not to make legal room for them. Not even willing to make room for the children who came to this country as babies, those what we call dreamers, whom I feel we're going to betray, who have lived their whole life thinking they belonged here, yet we as a nation can't seem to find it in our heart to make room for them. Right now, I think it's midnight for those right in our own community who just struggle and can't make ends meet, who don't even have enough food to make it a week at a time. You know, here we, with our guest table meals and our food pantry, we at least do something to make a little more room for them, provide a little for them. And it's important, but it's not enough to address the whole problem. And when I think of those parts of Africa where there is so little food, and I think about those who no longer even have a home in Syria and are fleeing the country, and those who are getting on ships that are overloaded and sinking in the Mediterranean Sea, you don't get on one of those boats unless it's midnight in your life. We must find a way to make room for these people. Right now, it's midnight for those, in one way, who work for an unlivable minimum wage and for whom the politicians, for all kinds of reasons, say, "No, we can't raise that." Right now, I think it's midnight for some people who struggle to get their health needs met properly, and for whom it's looking like the situation will soon get worse as prices rise and affordable care plans vanish. People will be told there's no room for you in this doctor's office or this hospital because you don't have insurance. The energy in our nation right now seems directed at assuring that the health reforms that have been accomplished that do allow some people to be able to afford coverage or not be denied coverage for pre-existing conditions will be repealed. It's midnight for those homeless folks in our cities who in this cold weather like today have all they can do to just keep from freezing. And sadly, it's midnight, I think, for Muslims who've become the object of suspicion and hatred. You know, since the election, through one offensive statement by all kinds of people and one act of hate after another, some are saying pretty loud right now that there's no room for Muslims or Jews or blacks or GBLT folks in our nation. It's clearly midnight for black people whose lives are valued less than white folks. It's midnight for mothers of black sons who are killed in our streets because racism is still strong among us. And it's getting to be midnight with respect to the growing income disparity in our nation. Today, as CEOs make obscene salaries, the gap between the rich and the poor is wider than it has ever been before. The have-nots are knocking, and it seems that those in our government just turn a deaf ear. I guess what we're saying in this country is that we make lots of room for the rich to get richer, but we're happy to let the poor get poorer. We're even saying, much to my disbelief in the year 2016, that there's no room for women at the top, that they don't deserve equal pay for equal work. You know, these exclusionary attitudes have been going on for a long time, but I feel things are coming to a crescendo, that midnight is fast approaching in so many areas for so many folks in our society, and that they're knocking harder at the doors. The doors of our elected officials, the doors of our courts and institutions, the doors of our churches, and yes, the doors of our hearts. Midnight can be a scary time. It can be a desperate time. It should be a time for us to be vigilant and not placidly accept the unjust treatment of the stranger or the poor or the ill person or the person of a different race or religion or sexual orientation, or gender identification. We just can't be part of that we that says, it's not my problem, or that we that says, let's just wait and see how it goes, or that we that's tainted with underlying racism or bigotry, or that we that just says, sorry, someone else got there first. No room for you. Last week, I preached on holding on to hope. And I firmly believe that we must do that and should do that. And the hope that I want us to hold on to is that we can, in our society, make more room for those who have the no room sign thrust in their face regularly. This is a time of opportunity for us to bring the principles of this faith into the debate of our time. And this is a faith tradition that is all about opening doors and making room for people. You know, look at our principles. What are we saying when we say those fancy words? We affirm the inherent worth and dignity of every person. What are we saying but that there is room for you here and equal space for you? When we say we affirm justice and equity and compassion in human relationships, we are saying that there's room for you in this society. When we affirm acceptance and world community with peace and liberty and justice for all, we're saying we believe that there must be room for you. But sadly, many in power in our nation today and over the years are not saying that. Ours This faith's message is one of radical inclusion. And it seems the power that be in our world are working overtime to exclude anyone who's not of that privileged, straight, white, male, European stock. If there ever was a time when we as a faith tradition were called to bring what we hold as sacred to the public debate, now's the time. The truth is, there is enough room at the inn if we're fair and equitable about things. So where do we start? We start by making more room in our own hearts. What acts will you do this year, this Christmas season, that at least make a little room for someone? Will you help to feed the hungry? Help to create housing for the poor? Reach out with support and friendship to those being demonized? Will you stand with the stranger? And we can start by doing more here at church, too. You know, it thrills me every time a person who's been excluded by others can come here and find a home. And it does happen a lot. But you know what? We can do even better, particularly in making more room for those of lower socioeconomic levels. Will you be a bit less interested in greeting your friends this Christmas and a bit more interested in extending a hand of welcome to someone who needs us to make room for them? It's all there in the Christmas story. I think that the Jesus born on Christmas in a stable must be remembered 2,000 years later, really because he brought a powerful message of radical inclusion to the world. A message that challenged the society of his time and still challenges the society of our time. A message to start making room. A message that said the test of one's faith is not the statement of belief that you make or the offering that you bring to the temple, but how you treat the poor and the downtrodden and the sick and the stranger. It's midnight for so many, and they're knocking at the door. How we as individuals and as a society respond is the test of whether we really get the message of this holiday. Christmas ought to remind us that people are always knocking at the door. We're called at all levels to respond with love and kindness and the sharing of resources. Again, this year, Christmas will come and go, and we'll have parties and exchange gifts, and we'll even share the love of the season. Maybe we'll even feel a bit of the spirit of peace and goodwill, and that's great. It's wonderful. But what about the other part of the story? Will we hear the knock? Will we answer the door? Will we make room in our hearts and our society, not just at Christmas time, but every day? One of my favorite theologians, Howard Thurman, put it so eloquently when he wrote these words. When the song of the angel is stilled, when the stars in the sky are gone, when the kings and the princes are home, when the shepherds are back with their flocks, the work of Christmas begins. To find the lost, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among the brothers, and to make music in the heart. Now I invite you to go forth with peace and love and certainly hope in your heart, to make room for those who are knocking at the door, to listen attentively to the message of the angels that are singing in you this season, and to seize every opportunity you can to share your love and your hope with others.